KQED.
Coming up in Forum's next hour, 40 years ago, a lightning rod student-led strike took place on the campus of San Francisco State University, and it had wide-ranging consequences, not only for the future of San Francisco State, but for college and university campuses throughout the United States. In the Forum hour ahead, we discuss the strike, its aftermath, and its legacy after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum. For 5 months in late 1968 and early 1969, students and faculty at San Francisco State University went on strike, led by minority students, to protest lack of minority representation on the campus. In a violent strike, a transformed university, the university inspired student activism across the country. The strike led to the creation of the College of Ethnic Studies at San Francisco State, which is the nation's first and only College of Ethnic Studies, and the campus is commemorating the strike with discussions and cultural activities. And we thought we'd have a look back and also talk about the legacy of that strike. Lorraine Chu is with us by phone this morning. She's now Associate Dean in the College of Ethnic Studies at San Francisco State, was one of the students jailed during the strike, and we welcome you. Good morning.
Good morning.
Also with us this morning is John Bunzel, Senior Research Fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford. He was Professor of Political Science at San Francisco State during the strike and became President of San Jose State. And welcome, John Bunzel.
Michael, it's always good to hear your voice.
Good to have you with us. And with us here in studio is Eric Solomon, Professor Emeritus of English at San Francisco State, was on the faculty at the time of the strike and was supportive of the students and critical of the administration's handling of the strike. Welcome, Eric Solomon.
Thank you, Michael.
Lorraine Chu, let me begin with you. I want to begin with you because the students played such a prominent role in the strike, and at least initially it was mainly black students or the Black Student Union. Then it fanned out and took in pretty much all ethnicities, became kind of a rainbow coalition. But tell us a little bit about the background of it and how you became involved and what you remember particularly in terms of now 40 years later.
Yeah, well, 40 years ago, it's really sometimes difficult to recall all the details. But basically, I was born and raised in the city and pretty much in a very culturally, culturally specific neighborhood like Chinatown, and really had no clue, in regards to the racial dynamics of the time, because at that time I think it was pretty much a black and white issue, and yet, you know, many of us grew up with stories within our own community, particularly the Chinese American community, because of exclusion for up to 1942. Then the 50s was, you know, we were just coming out of it, and the stories that were told, basically, you know, not widespread. Parents didn't want to talk about it. But watching my parents deal with racism was an interesting thing. And so I think by the time I went to college, there were a lot of unanswered questions for myself in regarding to how I would fit in this American context. And
well, forgive me, you had an experience, I believe, where your father was called a dumb Chinaman or something like that?
Yes, he was, you know, because we had a laundry on Polk Street. And I think I had never seen my father deal with non-Asian people because he worked specifically in Chinatown, in a place called Chinese Sky Room, which is a nightclub catering primarily to tourists, of which we were not able to go to. But when I saw him work at the laundry, in terms of how he dealt with, you know, consistent kind of negative racial name calling, I was appalled, you know, as to how he reacted to it, and I was not happy. But then I saw that that was the way he coped with it. He usually kind of laughed it off like it didn't matter. And while I would be in the back wondering why he would just laugh it off and not say anything.
So was that kind of experience which drew you to the
strike? And plus my own experience was I basically went through public schools in Chinatown that were predominantly Chinese, and there was very little outside contact with other kids of other groups. And when I went to high school, it was otherwise. It was predominantly with Caucasian kids. And I was called certain names, not, you know, always negatively, but you know, things like, oh, well, those Chinese girls always ruin it for us, you know, and being labeled, not necessarily just, oh, those girls, but specifically as a Chinese girl, I was like floored, like, now, where did that come from? So, you know, we had our own little stories. They may not be huge, but, you know, when you go through that consistently, it does make it have an effect in terms of questioning who you are in the American context.
How did we go from that kind of questioning to winding up in jail, which you did during the story?
Well, you know, many of these instances has to do with the time in which we were brought up, correct? You know, the 60s, I mean, I was not totally out of the loop in terms of knowing what the racial landscape was in terms of the larger society. You know, I, you know, was very impressed with first President Kennedy and then Martin Luther King. And then later on when I came here, you know, people like Malcolm X. And I finally realized that there were common histories among certain, you know, people of color. And that was not necessarily an education that I was privy to when, you know, from K-12. And so after meeting other students, particularly of my own racial group that grew outside of the city, grew up outside of San Francisco, going through the similar experiences and then having it, you know, relate to African-American students with similar experiences, it didn't take much and it didn't take long for me to be impassioned with the audacity that we can change this.
It was a violent strike, though, wasn't it?
Well, yeah, I didn't remember it as that, you know, and I think that, you know, whatever violence was, I guess, signaled in that time period, many of the people have been, quote, tried, and whatever came out of the court systems around that, you know, that they, you know, either paid a price or were not found guilty. But I think I was very concerned that that's what people have been highlighting. And I like to pose out there, you know, there were, you know, we were at a time of war in this country. And, you know, there was also government violence against people. And yet, you know, it hasn't always been seen or tested or, you know, ruled on that fashion either. You know, so it's not that balanced.
Lorraine Chu is now Associate Dean at the College of Ethnic Studies at San Francisco State, was one of the students involved in the strike 40 years ago and was jailed. And the demands of the strike, they were, in fact, I think a phrase was non-negotiable demands, included more enrollment of black students, more black faculty, a third world college, and you now have ethnic studies. There was also a demand for the rehiring of Black Panther George Murphy, who was a graduate student and instructor, George Murray, excuse me. Who actually urged, at least according to news reports, black students to bring guns on campus. There were a lot of controversial things for the times, particularly. Do you think now, I mean, here you are in the College of Ethnic Studies, was it worth it, all that effort and all that, well, spending time in the hoosegow, as they say?
You know, for myself, I think the interesting and the more positive outcome of the strike was the fact that many of us really believed that alignment of community to the university, you know, the outcome of community service learning was very much part of what the strike, you know, advocated for, that there was a better connection between who we are and who we are going to serve and the university. And so, you know, in that sense, I think the college really never forgot that, and it still hasn't. And I think the university has benefited with those ideals. And so, you know, was it worth it? You know, it totally, for myself, you know, altered my way of thinking and working in this, you know, in the profession that I chose, you know, which is basically an education. And it's, you know, that the social justice agendas that we have now, you know, it's outcome of that whole period of which we were part of. And I can't see a downside to that in that sense, because those of us who advocate for social justice, it is about improving the world, right? And those of us who don't advocate for it, you know, doesn't necessarily mean it's improving the world.
Eric Solomon, you and other faculty went on strike pretty much for the kind of reasons we're hearing from Lorraine Chu, or?
Well, of course, there was a variety of reasons. It was the times. There was political action all over the world, with students protesting in Paris and marching, and with students fighting in various ways the Vietnam War, and with people who had been down south registering voters and seeing violence there. But San Francisco State was a college, and it was a college in a place, and it did have a number of students who were interested in taking charge of parts of their own education that were not being handled, they felt, properly by a rather traditional, old-fashioned education system. And so in the 1960s, they started something. Actually, the student government started something called the Experimental College, where the students, raising their own money, paid for professors to teach courses, some of which were counted. And they were people, yes, generally from the left. Saul Alinsky, who trained a young man who is now running for president. And there's a link, I think, in all these things. Paul Goodman, Leroy Jones, and others. And when they got a large grant from the Carnegie Foundation to establish something larger than this on the campus, the administration at the time would not accept that money unless it were given to the administration, not to the students. And that's the background of why these protests, after long periods of negotiation and argument, led to the students deciding that they would take what they called strike action. It was not conventional. It was inside the campus rather than outside the campus the way picket lines usually work. And it led to rallies, and it led to students marching around, and there was some breaking of windows and immense police presence and
police brutality?
Violence, yes, yes. People were clubbed, guns were drawn, people were busted for old warrants. But mostly it was the horses, in my memory. They had about 100 mounted cops, well, maybe less. It seemed like hundreds to me, charging the students. There were guns in the halls in the hands of the police. It was a frightening time. The faculty strike, I just learned yesterday what it was about, which is not bad for somebody who was on the negotiating committee and was fired a couple of times. The students had been demonstrating. The police had chased them into what then was the student commons, where they ate, and there was a counter where the people served. And the students ran in, police after them, guns out, clubs in the hands. The students vaulted the counter, and the police were held off by the people, mostly of a variety of races, who worked as waiters and servers in the student commons. Many of these people lost their jobs, but they did not let the police get in and get these students who were able to exit. And the speaker at the time, and Harry Belafonte was there last night talking about this, was making a connection. He said, and I realized that that's what the faculty strike was about. Well, we had demands. We wanted to be a traditional strike. We wanted to get the labor council to authorize it. But we really wanted to stop the violence. Kent State had not yet happened, but plenty of people had been harmed and hurt in the kind of violence that was in the atmosphere. And we wanted to throw a picket line around the campus.
They also wanted collective bargaining at that point, too, didn't
they? Yeah, what we wanted was no one to be killed, really. That's what we wanted. And we wanted to somehow protect. I think what I learned was that we were classed by some of the student strikers, the faculty who tried to also sort of close the campus off, and we did from the inner violence. That did not happen anymore. That we were like the the staff that worked behind the counter. And I've always loved that. For the last 12 hours, I've been living with that idea. I think it's very nice.
This, of course, was a strike that brought into prominence S.I. Hayakawa, the senator who was famous for a tam o' shanter, as well as falling asleep when he became a U.S. senator. Narcolepsy was at least the official explanation. But let's go back to the question of legacy with you, Eric Solomon. Then we'll talk to John Bunzel, who has a very different take, I'm sure, on what happened in the whole history of this strike. It changed San Francisco State, according to Joseph White, faculty sponsor of the Black Student Union, to a multicultural campus. So it certainly, at least where San Francisco State is concerned, most people agree, had a major effect and created ethnic studies school. What about nationally? It seemed to be a lightning rod, didn't it?
I'll read you from Gavin Newsom's proclamation that declared today San Francisco State Student Strike Day. Whoever wrote this, I think, said it very quickly. Whereas, had it not been for the sacrifices made by these students, staff, and some faculty, programs like EOP, that's Educational Opportunity Program, Chicano, Asian American, African American, American Indian, gay and lesbian, women's, and disability studies would not exist. And whereas in 1968, the San Francisco State students played a vital role in the fruition of these programs that today inspire hundreds and thousands of students across the world to unite in the struggle for social justice, liberation, and access to quality education that truly represents that the vast experiences of all Americans, regardless of their race, class, gender, religion, sexual orientation, or physical ability. Now, this opened up all over the place. Not just ethnic studies programs, courses, in some cases actual schools, college, as we call it, of ethnic studies, but it opened up the whole realm of hiring as well. We have a multicultural faculty now. When I came here 40 years ago, we had a white faculty with a sprinkling of minority people on it, and mostly male. This changed. And why did it change? It partly changed because we had a college of ethnic studies here that we before were not unwilling to hire people of various colors and races and religions and orientations. But we were then a state college. Now we're a state university. We're not UC. We're not Stanford. We couldn't get all the bright and able minority candidates because they would get better jobs, lower teaching loads, and so on. But they saw that College of Ethnic Studies, and they said, you, San Francisco State, have put your money where your mouth is. You have a multicultural student body. This is where we're coming to teach. And so and that's happened in lots of places in the country that went this route. And so I think that's the heritage. I think it's an important one.
Eric Solomon, Professor Emeritus of English at San Francisco State, who was one of the faculty members involved in the strike. In fact, was one of the leaders from the faculty in the strike. And John Bunzel, at the time, was professor of political science at San Francisco State, was opposed to the strike and became president of San Jose State and is now at the Hoover Institution at Stanford. And John Bunzel, I guess you must have some real ambivalence about all this commemorating and maybe even lionizing about the strike.
Well, that's to put it rather mildly. Eric and I go back a long way. I can remember years before the strike when he and I used to have coffee together.
And talk baseball.
He was a Red Sox. Too bad. I'm sorry about the Red Sox this year, Eric.
I'm sorry, Jeff.
And I was a Yankee fan. But the strike, Michael, I have to tell you, I came back from the 1968 Democratic Convention in Chicago. I had been a delegate and put on the delegation because of my commitment to civil rights, and they wanted an academic. And I came back to a campus that suddenly found itself in the midst of something that I'm afraid today, the history of the strike, which I have a very serious disagreement with Eric, what happened on the ground in 1968 and 69, the months of violence and intimidation that tried to shut down the campus, I have the sense that this may all be forgotten or overlooked by those who 40 years later are looking back as if what took place was simply the triumph of virtue and morality and nothing but good. But there was a cost to to the university at that time, because San Francisco State became hostage, in my judgment, to those who believed that their non-negotiable demands justified their guerrilla tactics, no matter who might get in their way or get hurt. And it was, in many ways, a classic case of believing that their ends justified any means necessary to achieve them. And that's what put San Francisco State in the headlines across the country at the time. And it's a chapter in the history of the campus that should not be forgotten or minimized. Now, I realize, and Eric is correct, there was a police presence on the campus, but let's be very clear about the sequence of events. The police didn't come to the campus at the beginning of the year just because they had nothing else to do. There was an awful lot of violence and intimidation started by the students who, when they started to talk about their non-negotiable demands, there were various numbers of black leaders at the time who said very simply that they wanted a college of that would enable them to have a black studies department with 20 full-time faculty and staff. They refused the invitation of the then president, Bob Smith, to discuss them, insisting on a yes or no answer. Well, then became the other demands that were added by some of the other ethnic groups and other radicals who wanted to piggyback and add some other things. But in the weeks that followed and in the months that followed, a pattern was set. Students were educated, so to speak, on the aims of the strike, and teams of strikers, some all black and some all white, would rush into classrooms, announce the class's dismissal, and have often way of warning that there might be consequences if the class continued. The strike was used as an instrument, Michael, of agitation, and only to mobilize really what I think could be said they already committed, not only those people, but to radicalize the rest of the student body. The strike leaders understood that before they could seize power, which was their stated goal, that's what they wanted, they would have to employ their guerrilla tactics, as they were called, which with such effectiveness that the college administration would be forced into repressive counteraction that would build support for the strike.
Should we mention here also that you had a bomb set outside your office, that your classes were disrupted, your tires were slashed? I mean, this is personal in your memory, isn't it?
I had become a target of the Black Students Union because of an article I had written in a journal called The Public Interest, which you know well. And in that particular article, I had been earlier a strong supporter of a Black Studies program, but I always wanted it to be sound and academic. And in this particular article, I took issue with Nathan Hare, who had been brought on the campus, and he initiated his idea of a black student's department. And it was very clear, because he made no bones about it, it was to be all black, taught by black professors. It was not to be assimilationist.
Excuse me, John Bunzel, let me ask you, forgive me, but to hold that thought, because we're coming up on a break, and I want to remind listeners that this is an interactive program, and many of you who have memories of this particular strike or have questions about the history of it, still pretty polarized in terms of the way it's viewed. There were teachers, in fact, who were picking up checks during the strike who were pretending they were out on strike, and there's a lot of enmity. It's still to go around. If you would like to join us, you're welcome to do that, because we would like to hear from you. It's toll-free, 866-733-6786. Not only talking about the history, but the legacy of the San Francisco State strike. Again, our number for your calls, 866-733-6786, or you can send an email to forum@kqed.org. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. 40 years ago, students at San Francisco State University went on strike to protest the lack of minority representation on campus. It was called San Francisco State College at the time, and the violent strike, or what has often been characterized as the violence associated with that strike, really transformed the university and inspired similar action around the country. We're talking about the legacy of the strike with several of its participants. Lorraine Chu is with us. She's now Associate Dean of the College of Ethnic Studies, was one of the students who was out on strike and was jailed during the strike. And Eric Solomon, professor emeritus of English at San Francisco State, was on the faculty at the time of the strike and one of the leading figures in terms of faculty leadership with the strike. And John Bunzel is a senior research fellow, describes himself, in fact, as the token Democrat at the Hoover Institution at Stanford. And he was professor of political science at San Francisco State during the strike, became president of San Jose State, and as he's remarked here on the air, found himself as a target. And John Bunzel, sorry, we had to go to that break, but let me ask you to finish up your thoughts, if you would, please.
Well, I thank you, Michael. I understand that. I was trying to make the point that I was never critical of the idea of black studies, but of the particular perspective of Nathan Hare, who'd been hired during the summer to draw up a proposal for a department of black studies. And he'd been very clear about the kind of program that he wanted. He said that in his model of a black studies department, he wanted teachers who would work solely within what he called a black revolutionary nationalist framework. I don't want any assimilationists. And he had a curriculum all laid out in an article that I had written, Black English, Black Poetry, Black Music, Black English, Black Art, to be taught by black professors only, no white students. This was not the kind of black studies program that I thought belonged on a campus. Even from someone like myself who had been supportive of the idea of a black studies program with an interdisciplinary cast. And yes, you're right. Because of this article, I became a target. Because one morning in October, I think it was, they found a crude homemade bomb outside my office by one of my colleagues who happened to be passing by, and he heard it ticking. Well, you know, the people came in, the bomb squad, to dismantle it. No one was hurt, fortunately. Later, they said this was a property bomb, not a people bomb. That's what the radicals said. And then at home, my wife's car and my car were slashed and spray painted in the middle of the night. All of these things sound as if I'm some kind of sour grape old professor who looks back with some sort of sour in the belly feeling. But the fact of the matter is my major concern all the time at San Francisco State was something that I valued very dearly, and that was academic freedom. I had always regarded with a very real tenderness the fact that it didn't make any difference to me whether it came from off campus or whether it was on campus, off campus from the right or on campus from the left. Anyone with a liberal cast of mind who appreciated the core values of the university would want to stand up for those values, because violence of any kind, particularly on the part of students who felt they could hijack the campus to serve their own purposes, that was not what was really the essence of what a university should be. And I felt very strongly about this. And when we had trouble on the campus, when the students started to do their work, and a lot of other things, and I wasn't the only one whose office was trashed, there were many different kinds of stories. I'm sorry to disagree with the dean. There was a lot of violence and intimidation. And when it all got to the point where there was some necessary reason to have some police there, they brought them in. Now, I happen to believe that they brought them in with too much force too quickly. But when anything happens, for example, at home in your house, if you have a fire, you call the fire department. If you have a burglary, as happened in my house at this very time, you call the police. I will not blame the police for the strike at San Francisco State.
Now, let me go from there, if I may, because I want to also hear from callers on this. But I'd like to hear Eric Solomon and Lorraine Chu and some brief response to what you've heard from John Bunzel, because he's laid out a case of a lot of violence and intimidation associated with the strike. And also Nathan Hare, by the way, is a distinguished sociologist who wrote Black Anglo-Saxons. The idea that there was simply too much being asked for here in an unreasonable sense. Eric Solomon?
Go ahead, Eric.
Right. Well, Jack, we have argued before. yeah. We've even had cameras fake a moment when you came on the campus and I held a picket sign in your face and said, what are you doing here or something. I'm not going to get into detail except to say that this was the fourth time the police had been on the campus in the past 2 years before that. And there had been resolutions of academics who had said, don't do this, and then presidents who said, we must, and so forth. But what we were working with was a time period in which various people were representing various kinds of violence all over the world. When we were destroying in order to save villages in Vietnam, or whether we were colonizing around the world and economically and so on. And so there was a left and there was a right and there was a local struggle over who owned the university. And Clark Kerr said it is a multi-university over at Berkeley. Governor Reagan said you will not gather in the streets of Berkeley without being tear gassed. And so that it was a violent age, time. Yes, some of the student people, had read Mao, had understood about insurrection. But the majority, I think, of people, both faculty, students, staff, and so on, simply wanted to get some major change in a university, which did come, and which was inevitable and was important. But access came from the fact that here were these privileged students, because they, one way or another, like Lorraine, had gotten their way into San Francisco State, which did not represent as a campus, both with student body and teaching and administration and so on, the community where black people had come to Hunter's Point, where Asians had come earlier, where Latinos from various parts of the atmosphere were coming.
Lorraine, do you want a word in here?
Yes, well, what I, you know, like to go back to a little bit is, again, a balance in the perspective. You know, I, of course, was not part of the quote, what John is saying about the violence, you know. But what was more important is that as a student who was jailed that night with the mass bus and then subsequently spent more time later, you know, there was never reported that those of us who were in jail were hosed down with high-pressure hoses and swept off our seats to against the wall. I mean, we tried to tell the media chose not to present that side. In fact, distorted what had happened in the jail cells that evening. Okay, so what I said earlier in the show was that we shouldn't highlight the violence. And not only that, that the violence was on both parts, if we had to do that, and we need to put it in balance, you know, in that perspective. And secondly, in regard to the curriculum, I also like to say that in the 60s, you know, it was kind of, you know, in terms of the college, a birth of, again, balancing the perspective of curriculum that as a child in this country and educated in this country, I never had, you know, any information about in terms of our history. Now, assimilationist was very much what our country had brought us all to believe that that's how we fit. Having an alternative point of view may not have been popular for those who were in support of the assimilationist point of view. That's fine, but it's having a perspective that is different and that is your own voice that hopefully, you know, and you can tell with the students today, hearing that as history and living that in their world today has a very different effect than when I went to school in the 70s and hearing it.
Lorraine Chu, I know that you have to leave, and I thank you for spending this time with us, and appreciate very much your being with us here this morning. And I want to remind listeners that Lorraine Chu is now Associate Dean of the College of Ethnic Studies, which probably would have never been born, one could add, if it wasn't for the strike at San Francisco State, which he participated in as a student and was jailed in. Thank you again, Lorraine Chu. Let me get our callers in, and our first caller up is Asher. Morning.
Good morning, Michael. I was a deputy attorney general at the time all of this was taking place, and I represented, I was the lawyer for Sam Hayakawa. So I would have to go out to the campus on a number of occasions. The atmosphere was so tense and so frightening that I could not use a state vehicle. I had to use my own car. I could not wear a suit and tie. I went out there in jeans. But let me just give you kind of an amusing, diverting little episode. I went into Hayakawa's office to meet with him. The Black Student Union had filed a lawsuit making a grab for student funds, which amounted to hundreds of thousands of dollars. And Hayakawa was named as one of the defendants, and the student leaders, they challenged the student election, et cetera. Well, in any event, I went into Hayakawa's office at about 9:30 in the morning, and he brings out a bottle of bourbon. Now, I'm not much of a drinker under any circumstances, but I felt I had to drink with him. So he has a bourbon, I have a bourbon. He has a bourbon, I have a bourbon. Well, I walked out of there at about 10:30, smashed. I had to go back to my office and take a nap. So in any event,
he was known for his naps as well, of course.
Yeah, under other circumstances. But the postscript is that we won the case. We fended off the challenge to the student election and preserved the funds for the duly elected body, the student body group.
Well, Asher, good to hear from you, and I thank you. We're hearing, of course, by email from a number of listeners, just the contrast in two emails that I'm looking at right now. Here's Kim, who says, I was a sophomore art student during the riots. My biggest memories are the police baiting us, wanting an altercation, the media looking for something exciting, working in the glass studio on the weekend while the tax squad looked through the fence taunting me, can't wait to get you, girly, watching my boyfriend on trial and shocked at the lies. I don't remember much violence on the part of the students before the police got involved. And here's Doug, who says, on the other hand, I was a student at SF State at the time of the strike. I recall classroom invasions, newsstands tossed in a 19th Avenue traffic, and a general my way or no way. The strike did not represent the student body at large. It represented a minority forcing their proposals on the school by violence and intimidation. To romanticize the events at that time is to falsify history. And there you have it. Eric Solomon? John Bunzel. Go ahead, and then Eric Solomon. Yeah.
Michael, can I make a point here? You had raised a moment ago and the only way I can possibly relate to all of this is by doing it in terms of some of the anecdotal stuff that happened to me. My class, I had a class that was given every year to upper division students, held about 40 students. On this particular occasion, all of the members of the Black Student Union and the Students for Democratic Society, all the groups that were the militant groups on campus, enrolled in my class. And they had no other purpose, as they stated very publicly, but to shut it down. They were going to make very certain that Bunzel was not going to be allowed to teach this class. It was held in a big auditorium. I had the foresight at the time to invite Ernie Besick, who was the president of the American Civil Liberties Union, to come into and witness what was going on or what I thought was going to happen in that class. And I came out on the first day and then tried to introduce them to the curriculum, the reading list, and I was shouted down. The waves of the Red Book of Mao were all in the air and everything else, and all mayhem took place for three straight days. And at the end of all of this, Ernie Besick made a very public statement. He said, I do not understand how Dr. Bunzel was so patient for so long. He was being intimidated. It was not the other way around. This was an absolute disgrace. The classroom is a principle that cannot be compromised, he said, because it involves nothing less than the integrity of the academic process, and we at the ACLU will not defend these protesters. This is something that I think goes to the heart of why I feel so deeply about the principle of academic freedom. I do not have much of a quarrel with anyone who wants to increase the number of minorities and all of the rest. That's been part of my DNA for a long, long time before I came to San Francisco State. But I do have a very serious question about whether or not any means is necessary and justified to achieve legitimate goals. And sometimes when those means become coercive And when they become intimidating, I think they are simply improper tools, improper methods for a university.
Well, that was the phrase of the day, by any means necessary.
Yeah, by any means
associated with Malcolm X. I think Eric Solomon wants a word in here. Though.
Well, I don't want to argue with Ernie Bessig again on this one. I was once head of an ACLU in Columbus, Ohio. I believe in academic freedom and always have. But I was sensitive to the fact, as some of us were, that in volatile fields such as political science, let us say, and economics, and even in English literature or American literature, that they were asking some of the students different questions. Certainly, I was not about to teach students about Richard Wright's novel, Native Son. I brought in a medievalist who happened to be a African-American to talk to them. He didn't know he wanted to, but afterwards he did, and it was a good class, and it was interesting. Now, I gave away some of my academic freedom, I guess, because I saw it being taken away or never allowed to people who weren't able to break in a sense, to the profession or to be students in the academy. And there is no real political change, I think, that totally can come without excesses on both sides, not largely in the rhetoric, but often in things that could, actions that could be misinterpreted. And when you're dealing with a lot of young, angry people in a time when a country is, seems to be on a violent all over the world action, there will be matters that we can't condone. I never liked the idea of going into other people's classes. I think that was a huge tactical mistake, but they were the young and they were doing it their way.
Let me bring more of our callers in here. And Keith, go ahead. You're on.
Hello. I'm enjoying the conversation very much. I love the passion this has unleashed. I have also an amusing story like the previous caller. I grew up across the street from San Francisco State, and I was 4 years old at the time. And sometimes we'd have to come inside. My mom would make us come inside because of the clouds of tear gas flying over. You know, we couldn't play outside. But I also remember, like, looking out my bedroom and watching the student protesters, and I was really, even at that young age, I was inspired by that. I always remember it, and the students walking with their signs and everything, it was inspiring. I have a second, just a small minor point. My father actually went on to work with S.I. Hayakawa during his Senate years, and I know, Michael, you've taken a couple of digs at him, but he was a serious person. You know, he was an author. He was a smart person. He had ideas.
Take nothing away from the contributions he's made to the field of semantics.
Thank you very much for that.
And but also, as a senator, he was asleep a lot of the time, I'm sorry to say. But let me go to more of your calls. Roy, you're on. Morning.
Yes. I was a graduate student at San Francisco State years after the strike, but really my connection to it is that my ex used to be a student there. She was a student during the time of the strike.
Mm-hmm.
And am I on?
Yeah.
Okay, good. And she had actually chosen San Francisco State over Berkeley because she wanted to get a stress-free education. And she was not involved in any of the protesting or radicalism or anything like that. But really what happened was that the police became a third party to the strike. The tax squad actually covered up their badge numbers and went looking mostly for more vulnerable people. And my ex was actually beaten up with a baton as she was going from class to class. So she wound up dropping out, actually, and never did complete her college education, unfortunately. So, this was another, it wasn't just the university and the protesters, the police were actually a third force.
Well, I thank you for that call.
Can I?
Yeah, Eric Solomon.
Yeah, this is a very odd coming from me. Let me say something about the police at San Francisco State. I somehow ended up as picket captain at 19th and Holloway during a lot of the strike, where I had a lot of dealings with a guy who I think he was a sergeant then, George Amiel, who was quoted in the Chronicle last week. Listen, this was a decent guy who was trying as hard as he could to limit the kinds of violence were going on. And what he explained to me, and I talked to some of the policemen, they couldn't understand why these students who were getting a college education, which most of the police had been denied, why they would want to stop people from going to class. It was just beyond their imaginations, and that was the source of a lot of their anger and confusion. And I must say that I've been in areas in those days in the campus when the police were quite frightened.
Do you call that class envy in some sense,
perhaps? I think it was part of an unexpected aspect of the class struggle.
Could John Zbenzel, you want to comment on that?
Well, there's no doubt about the fact that a campus is not the natural habitat for the police. When I went to San Jose State several years later, we made it very clear there that the police were not welcome on this campus unless there was some dire emergency. This is not where the police belong. An academic community is open to everybody. It has no fences. It has no barricades. People can walk on the campus. And this was true at San Francisco State before the strike. Any campus is vulnerable to any group that wants to try anything. Most of the time, people come on the campus, have a cup of coffee, listen to a speech, encourage those who want to carry placards. What they don't want, and what we really cannot excuse, is the fact that a campus turns to violence because there is violence in the world. That is not really something that I can accept as something really justified. Of course there's violence in the world, but one of the prizes of a university is that it is a different institution. And it has its own values, and it has its own kinds of rules, norms. And one of the things we try to do, Bob Smith tried to do it, others have tried to do it in other places, is to negotiate. These students, I'm sorry to say, were not willing to negotiate. Their demands were very clear, and they wanted them yes or no. And that led to a climate in which coercion and intimidation became part of the culture. The students themselves, the black students, felt that this was an area in which the campus was being repressive. They looked upon the campus as part of American society, which for them was repressive because it was capitalist and imperialist and racist. If there is anything that can be said about San Francisco State, it has never been racist, it has never been imperialist, and it was never a haven for those who wanted to tear down the place in the name of some larger violence that was going on in the world. A university is very special. It's not the General Motors plant. A faculty union ought not to be like an industrial union in which students' grades are held up because they get somehow caught up in all of this. The strike itself was inappropriate for the purposes of what a university is about. There's a lot of retrospective determinism here going on in terms of how we connect what happened then with all the nice things that are going on today. And I admit there are some good things that have developed. But I draw a line from Martin Luther King, to whom I had many, many commitments and for whom and whose causes I supported fully. I draw a line from him to Barack Obama. I don't draw a line from Nathan Hare and Stokely Carmichael and Eldridge Cleavage and the black nationalists and the black power people who subverted the very principles of Martin Luther King.
Yeah, I hate to correct you, Judge. Eldridge Cleaver, though. Cleavage. He did wear a codpiece at one time, so maybe that's where the Freudian slip got in there. But I want to read a few emails here, and I know Eric Solomon wants to respond to you. Seth writes, I was a student at San Francisco State during the strike and an active striker. A lot of what John Bunzel says about intimidation and strong-arming is true. The strikers would broach no criticisms or challenges from the center or right, and you had to be extremely sensitive to criticize from the left. It got to the point where opponents to the strike or the BSU would be shouted down and told no free speech for fascists. We were in a thrall of a huge crowd mentality that swept many of us away. Here's another listener who wants to be anonymous. Says, I'm a graduate of San Francisco State's College of Ethnic Studies, now a TA in the UC system. I'm teaching my students about the San Francisco State strike as well as other contemporary activities. Many of my students didn't know this history and are responding with inquisitiveness and passion. This is part of the legacy of that movement. Here's a listener who writes, I was in the graduate program and a teaching assistant in the School of Business at SF State during the strike. This was not a legitimate strike in the community held definition, but rather it was insurrection, terrorism, and violent civil disobedience. The Summerskill administration kept the police off campus while the striking students burned the bookstore, trashed the administration building, and were beating up innocent students who were trying to go about their business. Only when Governor Reagan had enough and put Hayakawa in place were the police allowed on campus to put down the insurrection. The strikers may have had legitimate complaints and desires for change, but the United States has always prided ourselves as a civilized society, able to work things out. I was offended that the left-leaning Mayor Newsom lionized the event as an important milestone in San Francisco history. It was nothing short of domestic terrorism, and the leader should have been locked away like most criminals. The irresponsible actions of the radical minority impacted tens of thousands of hardworking, dedicated students, and that is not the American way. Eric Solomon, only about a minute left.
Well, there are a lot of American ways, and that's one I don't want to walk down. But I would only mention that it is, after all, a state university. People can come on that campus because it's state property. And indeed, always interested me that we were on the same payroll, the faculty of San Francisco State, as the State Highway Patrol. So that it's very difficult for some people to believe that for most faculty and for many students who were not political, we had chosen our fate to be part of something that was a state operation.
Well, we have come to the end of the hour, but the battle over history continues, and I want to thank those who participated in this morning's program about the history of San Francisco State, Lorene Chu, who was with us earlier, Associate Dean of the College of Ethnic Studies, Eric Solomon, Professor Emeritus of English at San Francisco State, who was on the faculty at the time of the strike and one of its leaders, and John Bunzel, Senior Research Fellow now at the Hoover Institution at Stanford and who was Professor of Political Science at San Francisco State during the strike. I want to thank our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and our producers, Kevin Guillory and Judy Campbell, our forum interns, Sarah Bahat, Susan Breton, Tariq Fauda, Aliyah Madyun, Kelly Pretzer, and Jeanette Yu. And this is Kelly Pretzer's last week, and we wish her well, and we thank her for all her good and diligent work with us. Also want to thank you, our listeners, as well as our callers. We would not be here without you and our emailers, and remind you that you are listening to your public radio station, KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.